are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Moments before boarding a passenger flight on May 11, 2019, as the first officer, pilot Christian Kit Martin, a former Army Ranger, was arrested by a swarm of heavily armed officers for the murders of three of his neighbors. The arrest captured global attention as Martin's mugshot, clad in a pilot's uniform, spread across the internet, sparking a media firestorm with headlines such as "Monster in the Cockpit." A combat helicopter pilot, Kit Martin had seen his life unravel after seeking a divorce. His wife's threatening words, "If you leave me, I will ruin your life," overheard by his daughter, seemed to have become a grim reality, escalating to a court-martial and culminating in a high-stakes murder trial at which he was convicted. "I will ruin you." The twisted truth behind the Kit Martin murder trial delves into the complex circumstances behind Martin's story. It looks beyond the sensational headlines and legal turmoil into the heart of this controversial case. With an investigative journalist's eye, author Emilio Corsetti III presents the facts of the crime that led to the arrest and the extraordinary lengths used to secure a conviction in this unforgettable true crime page-turner. The book that we're featuring this evening is "I Will Ruin You, The Twisted Truth Behind the Kit Martin Murder Trial," with my special guest, author Emilio Corsetti III. Good evening and welcome to the program, Emilio Corsetti III.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much and congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
Let's talk about right away the cast of characters that you introduce and the location where all of this emanates from. Talk about in Christian County, Pembroke, Kentucky.
Well, the book starts off with a specific date, and that date is September 5th, 2012. And the reason it starts off with that date is because everything that transpired for the next 10 years, occurred on that date. And at the time, Kit was living in Pembroke in a house that's become known as the Yellow House. They were living in the Yellow House in Pembroke, which is a small rural town in the southwestern corner of the state. His daughter Mackenzie was living in the house. And then Joan, his wife, and her three kids, EJ, Alma, and Essie, were all living together. But on this particular night, things had reached a point where there was an argument, and that argument led to Kit asking for a divorce. And that set everything in motion because Joan's response from that statement was that she was going to ruin his life and his military career by accusing him of abuse and adding that she knew how to do it. And she certainly did.
You say this story seems to evolve and she asked for information. She's in a particular situation if there is going to be a divorce. Dire straits. So she's asking some questions while she's just beginning to make allegations and just beginning for her to be asked if she wants some assistance from police. Tell us about that.
Well, so on that night of the September 5th, 2012, when Joan makes her threat to ruin his military career and his life by accusing him of abuse, Kit makes the decision. He basically says, okay, if you want to accuse me of abuse, I'll call the police and you can make your accusation right now. So that's what he did. He called the police, and then moments later, Joan got on the phone and she called 911 accusing Kit of domestic abuse. So that night, the police, three officers arrived at the scene, and it was decided that Kit and his daughter Mackenzie would leave the residence, and then Joan declined any medical help. She declined going to an abuse center for abused women. But later that evening, she had a change of heart, and she decided to go to this abuse center because it would make her claims more credible. And her and her three kids left the house in Pembroke and went to the shelter in Hopkinsville, Kentucky.
Now, tell us about Joan, her history as far as Kit Martin is concerned, and the circumstances in which he met her and the situation that he believed that she was in at the time that they did meet.
So Joan came into the picture after his divorce from his first wife, Stacy. So Kit wasn't someone who did a lot of dating, and he put a personal ad. That's how he found his fiance also is the personal ad. But he put a personal ad in the paper, and Joan was one of the women who responded to that ad. When they met, Joan told this elaborate story how not on the night that they met, but within weeks of meeting. Joan came up with a story that she was being abused by her husband, and that she felt threatened by him, and that he was abusing her children. And so Kit made the decision to help her move out of what he thought was her apartment, because her, as Joan had told him, that her ex or her husband was stalking her. So he helped move Joan and her three kids into a rental property that he co-owned with his wife, his ex-wife, Stacy. So that's how that relationship went. And at that point, the kid had decided that he wasn't going to have a relationship with this woman, but he was going to help her and her and those three kids because he believed that she was being abused and that her husband was stalking her ex-husband, as she explained it. But as it turns out, and he would learn this later on, not only was Carlos her ex-husband, she was still married to him in the apartment that Kit had helped her move out of. Was actually their shared living space. So they did this while he was at work. So the whole thing was a lie.
You say that Kit realizes with a combination of her stories and inconsistencies and just her overall seem like her lying behavior and wanted to break up with her. But you say that she got him back by talking about that her brother had died in Iraq. So,
you know, and I still have not been able to verify the veracity of that story. But what happened was, I guess Joan had sensed that Kit wasn't going to be in the picture. So she I don't know. It may very well be true. I have some information that indicates that it may be true that her brother died in Iraq, and Kit had decided to meet up with Joan to console her. And then that rekindled the relationship. Then the next thing that happened was that Kit was deciding he wanted to get back into the military. At that time when they met, he was just in the reserves. He wasn't full-time military. But since he was divorced and free to do whatever he wanted to do at that point, he made a decision he was going to go back into the military full-time. But at that particular time period, if he did go back into the military full time, there was a real high probability that he would be sent overseas. And by this time, Kit had come attached to Jones' children, especially the two young girls. So he made kind of a rash decision, and they went to the courthouse to sign, get the paperwork for getting married, and they ended up signing the paperwork and finalizing the marriage right there at the clerk's office. And so he was shipped off to do some military work, I think for 6 months to a year, and then they went to Germany, just as he had thought he was going to be sent.
You say they came back to the U.S. in 2010, and they moved to Rhode Island.
Right.
And Kit pursues a master's degree in national defense at the Navy War College.
Right.
Now, they have a house in Pembroke, Kentucky. But what is the marriage characterized by, especially in terms of her behavior, and who does she seem to be spending a lot of time with?
Well, they hadn't spent a lot of time before they got married. And then because of his full-time military commitments, and when they went overseas to Germany, Kit spent, he had three tours of duty in Iraq. One was on it as a ground, was on the ground, and then two tours were as an Apache attack helicopter pilot. So he was gone a lot of the time. And when he was home, he was only home for a few months before he was shipped off for another tour of duty. So they hadn't spent that much time together. And then when he went to Rhode Island, he was going to school full time at the War College. So their time in Pembroke, which they would have moved to Pembroke, I guess, in 2011, was the first time that they actually spent some time together. And I should mention that Pembroke is a very short drive from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where Kit was based with the 101st Airborne Division. So that was when things had started to sour long before that. But by now, though, it was a constant tension in the relationship. And it was as witnessed by Kit's daughter, Mackenzie.
So you introduce a neighbor, Calvin Phillips. So tell us what the word is or the rumor is around.
So Joan, she was a homemaker. She didn't work. That was a source of frustration and arguments, the fact that Kit was the sole provider. But, I mean, she was maintaining the household. But while Kit was at Fort Campbell, she would often spend time with the neighbor across the street, Calvin Phillips, and his wife, Pam Phillips, was someone who also spent the day working at a bank. She was a compliance officer at a bank in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. So while Kit was at Fort Campbell and Pam was at the bank, Calvin and Joan spent a lot of time together. And there were some suspicions that before this whole argument that there was something more going on. But the truth of that relationship, some of the facts of that relationship wouldn't come out till after this this big argument on September 5th, 2012.
Let's talk about what happens after that. Again, getting back to Joan, where she complains, what information she finds out in terms of potential aid for her. Now she's in dire financial straits. So what's the information that she learns? And then now what is the story that she is alleging happened?
Okay, so when Joan issued her threat to ruin his life by accusing him of abuse, the evidence points to the fact that she had just been waiting for an opportunity to introduce these images that she had taken of her son, Elijah Harmon. who had some injuries to his back, to his neck, and to the side of his face, which she claimed was caused by a beating from Kit over an incident that happened when he was in Rhode Island. So that was, she had just been waiting, actually in the weeks before this, this argument that led to Kit asking for a divorce, Joan had been showing these pictures all over the place. She would, anybody that she came in contact, she was showing these pictures, trying to show that her husband had abused her, her child. And she had the proof to show for it, right? She had these images. And so when everything got set in motion, when Kit asked for a divorce, Joan was already, she had everything planned out. She knew exactly what she had to do. She had to contact the Child Protective Services on the civil side, and she had to contact the Child Advocacy Program with the military to get things rolling on that side. And she let everybody know about these images because that was really the only proof other than what the kids would actually say once they were questioned by investigators. And at some point, it was cleared by civilian investigators from any kind of abuse with the children. But there was there were multiple investigations, actually, that resulted from both these pictures that, that Joan had of alleged abuse and some computer, a laptop computer and some CDs that were labeled with top secret and Kit's name on them. And that was handed over to the FBI. The FBI handed it over to the military. And then another investigation was started about Kit potentially being an international spy. So he had all these things. He was, you know, he spent all his time trying to put out all these fires that, that Joan was starting in her goal of trying to ruin his military career in his life. And things progressed from just a simple slap on the wrist because he had this classified information on these, on this computer, which did belong to him, and it did contain classified information, but there is a story behind that. And Kit denied beating EJ, Elijah, or the two girls. But and then when the investigators came to question the kids, they basically said, "Yeah, he's like the worst person in the world." And that thing moved things further from just a slap on the wrist to eventually, not only was he facing a court martial, but because of the way things developed in this particular case, with accusations building on top of accusations on top of accusations, he was facing up to 58 years in prison, in military prison, for sexual assault. Because at one point, when Joan felt, well, see, when the news broke that Joan wasn't legally married to Kit because she was still legally married to her first husband, Carlos, that threw a wrench into Joan's plans of getting military assistance, because now she was not the spouse, the legal spouse of a military member. So knowing that she couldn't get military assistance, she couldn't collect on his retirement, she wasn't able to get any kind of benefits from the military over these child abuse claims because they weren't married. But what she could do without being married is accuse him of sexual assault, which was another accusation that she brought on almost 18 months later after she had asked for a divorce, after investigators had already questioned her repeatedly, multiple times, Is there anything else you want to tell us? Is there anything else you want to tell us? But, you know, so now she accused Kit of sexual assault while they were married. And, you know, I can't prove this, and I don't know if this was the motivation or not, but you can collect benefits, military benefits, in a sexual assault, even if you weren't married to that person. It happens all the time.
Now, who is questioning this narrative from Joan? And as a result, who do they want to question specifically?
Well, okay, so Joan makes an accusation that Kit is responsible for child abuse. She has these images of EJ. But the problem is she has nothing to back it up other than what her three kids are saying and what she's saying, right? She never filed any kind of police reports. You would assume that if EJ had received this beating that left all these marks on his body, that she would have had medical attention. She would have filed charges, accused him of abuse at that time, but she didn't do that. So investigators were going looking for corroboration of this abuse, and they weren't finding it. They did everything. They questioned neighbors and co-workers in Germany and military members in Germany who worked with Kit and knew Joan. They questioned neighbors that lived with near Kit in Rhode Island. They questioned, you know, about a year after the divorce, that the Kit had asked for a divorce from Joan, he met another woman online, Laura. So, you know, investigators came up with this lie that they wanted to do a security search of the house, and that Kit knew about it. Well, not only did Kit not know about it, but he was being detained on base while they conducted this basically illegal search. And the reason they were doing this search is because among the accusations between Joan and her kids was that Kit had used a bamboo stick and a Roman whip whenever he beat the kids. So they went there to question Laura under the guise of doing a security check, when in reality, they had another ulterior motive, which was to find evidence of this bamboo stick or this Roman whip, which they didn't find. And in addition to that, they interviewed Laura and her two kids. And when they interviewed the Jones' three kids, they interviewed them as a group. Now, speaking of the book, The Edge of Doubt, which involves child abuse, one of the things that you do is that you interview the children separately.
Right.
Right. But they interviewed them as a group, and they made statements that contradicted later statements. But when they interviewed Laura and her two kids, they denied that there was any abuse. There was no sexual misconduct between Kit and Laura's daughter. They also interviewed Kit's children, two kids. And of course, there was no abuse alleged there. So despite their efforts, they were unable to find any corroborating evidence of abuse. That's sort of where Calvin comes into play in this whole scheme. This whole story is because Calvin and Joan together brought the laptop and the CDs to the FBI. They were interested in Calvin because of his connection to that classified information. And when they called to Joan, had apparently had made copies of these alleged abuse images. And when the investigators investigating the classified materials called Calvin to ask him more about this classified information and how he came about finding it, Callan had made a statement that he had these pictures of alleged abuse of EJ. And then that elevated what was, like I said, it was supposed to be a simple Article 15 in the military, which is a slap on the wrist for mishandling classified information, into much more serious charges of child abuse. Calvin, as things progressed and they were unable to corroborate Jones' accusations, they started to rely more on Calvin as opposed to Joan, because as the investigation progressed, they learned that Joan had lied about the father of EJ, who she had claimed had died in a logging accident and had been beheaded. Now, that turned out to not be true. Then Joan had lied about being divorced from her husband, Carlos. Not only was that not true, but she had taken her two young girls and EJ and moved without notification of where she was going. And Carlos was unable to locate her and had not seen his two girls for over 10 years. So Joan's credibility had slowly been going down in the minds of the JAG prosecutors. Their decision was they were going to rely on Calvin to be their star witness. The problem with their plan, though, is that Kit had hired a private investigator, and the private investigator was the one who found out about the fact that Joan wasn't divorced. He hired another private investigator who learned that EJ's father had not died in a logging accident. The private investigator, they went and interviewed Calvin. Actually, there was a very lengthy interview that Calvin agreed to do that took place actually in Pembroke in front of his house under the tree in his front yard. In that interview, Calvin made statements that he was not aware of. Joan had never said anything to him about being sexually assaulted. Joan had never said anything about him abusing the girls in a sexual way. And his only corroboration of abuse was these pictures, which was given to him by Joan. So there was also the alleged affair. And when Calvin denied it once, there was evidence that pointed to the fact that there was an affair. At least there was some sexual, at least two witnesses had caught them in the act. So it's hard to deny that. But Calvin's statements that Joan had never said anything about a sexual assault or child abuse of the girls was very important to Kit's case and what turned out to be a court martial, because Calvin could say that, you know, he can deny that Joan had ever said anything about abuse, even though they were so close together in a relationship. So that's how Calvin became a witness, not only for the JAG prosecutors, but for Kit's defense in the court martial. And then as things progressed, the JAG prosecutors had set a plan in motion, because Joan was such an unreliable witness, and her accusation, especially of sexual assault, would not hold up under questioning. They decided that they were going to keep Joan on the rope on one hand, letting her believe that she was going to succeed in her goal of ruining Kit's life by putting him in prison for 50 plus years for sexual assault, while on the other hand telling Kit that they were going ahead with these sexual assault charges. When they had been found discussing this case in another proceeding where they had claimed that they weren't going to call Joan as a witness because she was not a credible witness. Even though everything all of the accusations against Kit had originated with Joan, right? Child abuse originated with Joan. The sexual assault originated with Joan. The laptop was in Joan's care. The CDs were in Joan's care. But so even though she was the originator of all of these, this evidence, and she had the images of the alleged abuse, they weren't going to use her as a witness. They were going to use Calvin as a witness. You had the JAG prosecutors wanting to use Calvin as a witness, and then you had Kit wanting to use Calvin as a witness because he can deny that Joan had ever said anything about abuse. So now we're getting into November of 2015.
Emilio, let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. There are times when you just can't trust your gut instinct, and many factors, including stress, poor diet, and the use of certain medications, can throw off your gut microbiome. So Ritual created a 3-in-1 supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. My wife Lisa and I have been taking Ritual's multivitamins for years now. So when Ritual introduced Symbiotic Plus, we immediately began taking Symbiotic Plus first thing every morning. Ritual has some other great products we've tried, such as Ritual's Hyacera Skin Hydration. Rigorously tested and validated by a third party for allergens, microbes, and heavy metals, Ritual invested in a study modeling the human colon, which showed Symbiotic Plus significantly increased microbial diversity and the growth of beneficial bacteria. Ritual multivitamins are vegan, non-GMO project verified, gluten and major allergen free, certified B Corp, and made traceable. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide, your insides. Get 20% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/murder. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/murder for 20% off. Now, you're talking about November 2015, and the situation is that the court martial is at hand, and then we have November 18th. But before that, in the book, you talk about something that happens, and we'll just mention it because it's very, I think it's very important, but something happens previous in the summer, June 28th, 2015, and there is a connection to Joan and this home invasion. Tell us about that home invasion before we talk about what happens November 18th?
Yeah, so the incident you're talking about is Joan was renting a house from this couple, this Mennonite couple. And there was a home invasion early in the morning, like 3 or 4 a.m. And there was a husband and a wife, an elderly man and woman, and they were both beaten. And the husband died from his injuries. And then the woman was so severely beaten that she suffered brain damage. And now, like I said, Joan was renting a house from that couple. And within days of this incident, her coworkers had noticed that she had been splurging on a new car, not an actual new car, but a new car for her. And she had been boasting about buying new clothes and buying new furniture for her house. And it was her coworkers who suspected that she had some involvement because she apparently was close to this couple and they knew her children. And so that's that story, that connection there. And that murder is still unsolved, right? But now in November, early November, of 2015, that the court martial is scheduled for December 1st, 2015. And so it's getting close. Everybody is, the court martial has come and gone. The dates have been changed and postponed and moved several times. But now it's scheduled for December 1st. And Kit receives a visit from an investigator that he's been working with on this for well over a couple of years. And he's very familiar with the case, Michael Kanzaki. So Michael ends up driving from California to deliver a car to his son, who's returning from overseas deployment to Fort Campbell. I think he was returning his truck. So, and at that time, Michael Kanzaki decided, well, Kit offered to let him stay at his house. So he did. He stayed at his house for like 2 weeks. But before he was getting ready to leave, they made a decision that they were going to go back and try to interview Calvin again to see if they can get, because the statements about where they found, how they found the laptop and the discs, and when they found it and who found it, there were contradictory statements, and they wanted to get it on tape about that particular issue. So Michael Kanzaki and Mary Martins, a private investigator who had been working on the case for Kit, also for well over a year and a half, they decided that they're going to do like an ambush type interview with Calvin at his home. So they go to Calvin and you know, they question him about the laptop. And by now it's getting, everybody's on edge. I mean, Calvin is on edge because he realizes the what Kit is up against and his role and everything. So he's uptight about it and feeling pressured. And he makes statements to other people, which are used later in a trial, about being concerned about what Kit Barton might do as a result of this court martial and his testimony. But they also confront him about the alleged affair between him and Joan. And when they confront him about it, and they say that it's going to come out in trial, at the court martial trial, Calvin doesn't deny that there was a relationship. His response was, so what? So they have that on tape. Let's go to the date that you had mentioned, which is November 18th, 2015. So they do the recorded interview on November 2nd, 2015. There's this confrontation, alleged confrontation between Calvin and Joan a day or two after that. And then on November 19th, 2015, the first evidence that a crime had been committed was a neighbor had noticed smoke coming from a farm field from John Homick's farm. And as he pulled closer to where he saw the smoke, he realized that it was a vehicle that was on fire. It had been on fire and was still smoking. So they called the fire department. The fire department comes, and then they discover that there are skeletal remains of two people inside that vehicle in this farm field. And the license plate to the vehicle identifies the owner of the car as Pam Phillips. So they immediately go to the Phillips' residence, which is right across the street from Kit's home, Caddy Corner. Eventually, after they obtain a search warrant, they discover that Calvin was murdered and his body was found in the basement of the house. So now there's three homicides, Calvin and Pam Phillips and neighbor Ed Danzero. So that's the crime that takes place. And suspicion falls on Kit almost immediately because, very conveniently, as investigators are going through the house, the Phillips's house, they get to the second floor, and as they get to the landing, right in front on a desk in the landing are two subpoenas for Calvin Phillips to testify in a court martial. So they call the Fort Campbell and they talk to the JAG prosecutors, and then the CID agents, criminal investigation division agents, everybody who's been working on this case for the past 2 years, trying to get this court martial of Kit Martin, they come to the crime scene and everybody is pointing the finger to Kit. He's military trained. He had Army Ranger training. He has multiple weapons in his house, including the two types of firearms that were used in the homicide. And then there's the fact that Calvin was going to testify in his court-martial. While the initial investigation was, the investigators were open-minded about who may have committed this crime, it wasn't long before they formed a tunnel vision on Kit Martin. And they focused all of their efforts and energy on trying to prove that Kit Martin had committed these three murders. And they did so by discarding exculpatory evidence and trying to explain away evidence that didn't fit their theory, which is basically what tunnel vision is.
You write about how complicated it gets in terms of he has alibi witnesses, and it comes down to, you explain, according to witnesses, when this crime was to occur around 2 a.m., and then it would take for the officials to say that and conclude that his wife, Laura, was absolutely lying on her husband's behalf in this case.
Okay, so there were two crimes. Well, let's make it three crimes committed at different times of the day. All right. So they're pretty confident that Calvin was murdered sometime between 7 a.m. and say 9:30 a.m. And the reason that they narrowed that window, the 7, I believe that's close to the time, 7 to 9:30, because that's when Kit was alone at home. The Jones' two kids had gone to school, and Laura had left for work very early that morning. So Kit was alone at home, right across the street from 7 o'clock to like 9 o'clock. 9:15 or whatever, that he left to go to work at Fort Campbell. The other part of this timeline is that Friday, so this was a Wednesday, and on Friday, Calvin and Pam were celebrating a wedding anniversary, and their son Matt had bought them a washing machine for their wedding anniversary, and that washing machine was supposed to be delivered on November 18th, between 10 a.m. and noon. Now, when the delivery truck drivers, or the driver of the delivery truck, arrived at the Phillips' house at around 10:40 a.m., they couldn't get any contact with Calvin. And they also called Pam at work and said that they were unable to get Calvin on the phone, so they were going to have to reschedule this delivery of this washing machine. So that's the timeline when they believe that Calvin was murdered, which it's in that little, it was definitely before, it was after Pam had left for work at 6-something, and it was before the delivery truck drivers arrived at 10:40. Assuming that Calvin wasn't being held at gunpoint, let's say. All right. So we're assuming that he had been murdered. Now, Pam is at work. Ed D'Angelo's in Bowling Green, and he's driving home to Pembroke at this time. Ed D'Angelo, the neighbor who lives right across the street, not across the street, but right across from the Phillips' house, gets home around 3-something, 3:40, 3:45. Pam, she's trying to get out Calvin to find out why he wasn't there when the delivery truck driver showed up. So Pam was someone who was usually like the first to arrive at work and the last to leave. But on this particular day, because she wanted to find out what was going on with Calvin, she decided that she was going to leave early, work early. So she, at 5 o'clock, she decides she's going to leave work. And as she's leaving for work, she gets in her car and there was a coworker was taking a picture of the sunset. And Pam drove by and asked if she would take her picture. That's the last picture of Pam Fertles in the car that would be found the next day, set ablaze. So Pam leaves for work a little after five. She gets home and she calls the neighbor, Ed Dansereau. Have you seen Calvin? And, you know, Ed's been alerted to the fact that, you know, Pam is looking for Calvin. So he's kind of looking out for him. And she plays back a message on her answering machine, and it's from a friend who had called, who had also been to the house looking for Cal with no success. And while she was on the phone with this family friend, the family friend says that Pam said, "Hold on a second, I think I see something." And then after that, she said she heard a scream. But she said it wasn't really a scream. It was like she was startled by something. And Pam never came back on the phone. She never said anything about hearing gunshots. But what we do know is that at around 5:30 p.m., November 18, 2015, Pam was shot and killed with a .22 caliber gun. What we also know is that Ed Dansereau, who was preparing dinner and whose kitchen window looked out right across to the back porch area and the back of the Phillips' house, saw or heard something that alarmed him to the point where he grabbed his phone and a pistol and he ran out of his door, headed over to the Phillips' house. And as he rounded a wooden privacy fence that was between the two residences, he was shot. And we know that because his phone and some blood was found in that area. And then he works his way along this privacy fence to the backyard of the Phillips' house, where he was shot again in the head. And we know that because there was blood and his pistol was found 60 yards from where the phone was found. So we know that this crime took place at around 5:30 p.m. Now, here's the interesting thing about this whole trying to fit the evidence to your theory, right? So Kit Martin, for reasons for his own security, had installed security cameras around his house. So his movements in and out of the house were recorded that entire day and the entire next day. The only thing was that he didn't have a camera in the front of the house, which would have caught the front door, because they never used the front door. The door had been warped because the house had gone unsold for 2 years without heat, and the front door, it was not functioning properly. A door stop that they used to put pressure on the door, they added some extra bolt locks to keep the door in the frame, and he actually nailed the top of the door into the frame, all in an effort to straighten this door out, all right? But of course, the prosecution would turn all of this evidence around because it didn't fit their theory, right? But here's the thing. So the security footage shows that at 5:23 p.m. that day, November 18, 2015, Laura's two kids, Austin and Emma, they're going to a group dinner with some other kids at school, right? They go to a religious school called the Christian Academy
Let's stop to hear these messages. Let's get to the trial of Kit Martin.
Okay, so what's important to know about the trial is before the trial, and even, before there was a trial, there was a grand jury hearing, all right? And that grand jury hearing was on May 10th, 2019. And at that hearing, the lead investigator testified that Pam Phillips's phone and Kit's phone were traveling. Well, first of all, he testified that the two phone, that Kit's phone was at the scene of where on Rosetown Road where the car was burned. That was one thing he said. The next thing he said was that Pam's phone and Kit's phone were traveling together south to Fort Campbell. All right. If you're on a grand jury and you're hearing testimony from the lead detective who says that the victim's phone was traveling with the defendant, I mean, that's pretty much a slam dunk. But it turns out that all of that testimony was false. And it wasn't true. And so they had asked for a dismissal just based on that, because you know, they basically got a murder indictment based on false testimony. Now, there was another piece of evidence, and that was a shell casing, which plays a important role in this whole story in this trial. So the grand jury testimony was false. That led to the murder, the indictment, and the Kit's arrest at the Louisville Airport the next day on May 11th. And this happened right just before, you know, it's 2019. It's just before COVID hits. So now there's a delay in the murder trial. He waits 2 years in jail. He can't get bond. He waits 2 years in jail for the murder trial. But so before, as we're getting closer to the trial, it's becoming evident to the prosecution that they don't really have a case. All they have is this shell casing that was recovered on the back porch that two ballistic experts had testified did come from Kit's Glock 45. So that was the other piece of evidence that the grand jury had, other than the false testimony about the cell phones. But even that evidence wasn't a slam dunk, because while the shell casing matched the 45 caliber gun, the bullets that were recovered from the body of Calvin Phillips couldn't be positively matched to his Glock 45. In fact, it was leaning towards the fact, in fact, the defense ballistics expert, his testimony was that it was unlikely that Kit's Glock 45 fired the bullets that killed Calvin Phillips. So it certainly wasn't a slam dunk. But before the trial even began, the prosecution offered Kit a plea deal. All he had to do was plead complicity to murder, and they would give him between, I think it was 5 to 15 years if he did that.
Right.
Okay, so you're talking about killing three people, and you're going to give the guy 5 to 15 years for that crime. And of course, Kit declined because he didn't have anything to do with it. So now they go to the trial, and the evidence that they have is contradicted by the alibi witnesses, which you'd already mentioned, right? So remember, we'd said that the murders of Pam Phillips and Ed Dansereau had occurred at 5:30 p.m. Well, at 5:23 p.m., like I said, Austin and Emma, Laura's children, had left to go to this group dinner. Okay, it's 5:23 p.m. Kit and Laura are home alone. They have the house to themselves, and they happen to be celebrating an anniversary. And we know that because of testimony, but we also know that Kit had brought roses home for Laura. All right, so it's 5:23 p.m. Now, if you believe the prosecution's theory, the kids are out of the house, they're getting ready. They have the home to themselves. They're going to celebrate the anniversary. But Kit disappears and goes across the street and kills two people. Then he comes back to the house, and Moore doesn't notice that anything is amiss. And then the third part of the crime occurs at 2 a.m. when the car was set on fire. And we know that because there are two witnesses that heard two explosions and one witness who saw the flames at 2 a.m. Well, we have three people now at the house in Pembroke that are home. We have Laura, Emma, and Austin. So to believe the prosecution theory, you have to believe that Kit got up at 1:10 a.m. because he had his alarm set for that. They went out through the front door, which they never proved functioned properly, and loaded two bodies by himself into a car, and drove it to a farm field, set it on fire, walked 4 miles back to the crime scene, got into Ed Dangero's car, drove it to Elkton, Kentucky, where Joan lived, and threw Pam Phillips's phone into her front yard, drove back, parked Ed's car 4 blocks away, walked home, got into bed, and nobody in the house noticed anything amiss. And the very next day, Kip spent most of the day with Laura's daughter, Emma, driving to her horse riding lessons. So, yeah, and the whole story, as far as how this, that's the theory that the prosecution laid out. But without giving stuff away, the whole theory of the crime, they didn't actually present it to the jury until closing arguments. And you would say, well, how can you do a 2-week murder trial and not present a theory of the crime until the closing arguments on the last day of the trial? And the reason is because everything points to multiple individuals involved in this crime, right? There were two different weapons that were used. There were bodies that were loaded into a car. There were two cars that were moved from the crime scene. Even the prosecution admitted that there was circumstantial evidence that there were more than one person was involved. But at no time had they identified a second person. So on the day before, the evening before the closing arguments, the defense had argued, because the original charges were that he was charged with complicity to commit murder, either by himself or with the aid of others. That was the original charges. And the defense argued successfully that at no point during the trial had they brought forth evidence of another individual. So the prosecution's plan all along for all these holes in their case was to say, well, he had help, and that's why we're charging him with complicity. We haven't identified this who helped him, but that's why we're charging him with complicity, because we all know that more than one person was involved. But the judge agreed with the defense and said, you know what, you can no longer argue complicity. So now they had to make up this whole stupid theory of the crime, of how this thing took place on the spur of the moment on the last day of the trial. And it doesn't hold up. I mean, it's completely disproven just by the phone evidence of Pam Phillips's phone, because Pam Phillips's phone pinged off a tower that indicated that phone was in the Pembroke area the day after the murders. It could not have been laying in the front yard of Joan Martin, as she claimed. And not only that, later in the day, in the evening, the phone pinged off another cell tower even further east of Elkton, Kentucky, where Joan lived, indicating that the phone was moving in movement somehow and not laying in the front yard, as was claimed by the prosecution and by Joan Martin, who pled the fifth at the trial and never testified.
How important was it that the judge allowed witnesses to say what they had, Kit had said, or what they had heard Kit had said.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that as the build-up to the court-martial, everybody was on edge. Kit was on edge, Laura was on edge. They weren't sleeping well. Calvin had expressed his concern, you know, what the ramifications might be if Kit was court-martialed. And this evidence of this alleged affair, you know, he rightfully was concerned. And he expressed that concern to a number of individuals. And Pam Phillips also expressed her concern to another person, individual, co-worker at the bank. Well, typically that's hearsay evidence. It's not allowed in a trial. But in this case, the judge made the decision, and it's explained in the book how this came about. But he used a portion of the law called forfeiture by wrongdoing, meaning if you kill somebody so they don't testify, you can no longer claim that it's hearsay evidence because you forfeited that right because you killed them. And all that's needed for this law to be applied is what's called the preponderance of evidence. So the judge, even though the trial had not begun and the evidence had not been challenged in front of a jury, it had been discussed in pretrial hearings, I will say that, he made the ruling that this hearsay evidence was going to be allowed because of forfeiture by wrongdoing. And that the preponderance of the evidence was that Kit had killed these three people, at least Calvin Phillips, to prevent him from testifying in the court martial. So it's a very complicated issue, this whole hearsay thing. But it certainly was detrimental to his case. And he was convicted in this trial, and the hearsay evidence played an important role in it. But what really played an important role is that there was so much deception that the prosecution used throughout the trial that by the time I actually interviewed one of the jurors, he had no clue about the prosecution's theory. It was like when I told him what the prosecution theory was, he said, well, that sounds implausible. And then he tried to make excuses about the phone movement. And then he had basic details about the case wrong, important details about the case. For example, the bullets that were used to kill Calvin Phillips were a very specially designed bullet called a RIP G2 research round, right? It was designed so that when it entered the body, it would break into eight different parts. So you had eight different pedals, or what's called trocars, separating from the bullet, traveling through the body, plus the bullet base, all right? And Calvin had received five shots with this ammunition, this RIP ammunition. But they never found, of all the ammunition that Kit had at his residence, in his truck, they never found any evidence that he had this type of ammunition, this very specialized ammunition. When I interviewed one of the jurors, I told him that, and he said, no, I think I remember seeing a picture of that ammunition in the back of his truck. All right. Well, that was part of the deception that was the prosecution had done early on in this trial, where they showed a bunch of pictures that were seemingly incriminating that actually had no connection to the case. And one of those pictures was a box of ammunition in the back of his truck. It was 45 caliber ammunition, and there was also a 22 caliber magazine. All right. Well, before we got to the picture, Ben already stated that Pamela and Ed D'Angelo were killed by 22 rounds, and Calvin Phillips was killed by a 45 round. And here we are, we're showing a picture of both types of ammunition in the back of his truck. And the ammunition box on the back of the truck said something like PRM or something. What it wasn't was the G2 research rounds. But in this juror's mind, and I don't know if he expressed this same mis, identification of this important evidence. But he, in his mind, he thought that he had that ammunition in the back of his truck, and he did not. And that was that's a crucial piece of evidence, because it's such a unique piece ammunition that if he did have that ammunition, it would lean further towards the points that maybe he did this, because the shell casing matched his Glock 45, and now here is that rare ammunition in the back of his truck. So it just goes to show you that, you know, even though these people sat, these jurors sat in this week in this trial for 2+ weeks, the whole prosecution theory of what happened wasn't thrown on them until the very last day in closing arguments, and none of them connected the dots.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about I Will Ruin You, the Twisted Truth Behind the Kit Martin Murder Trial. For those that might want to check out more about the story, can you tell us about a website or any social media you do?
Yes, if you go to emiliocorsetti.com, emiliocorsetti.com, you'll find all the information about this story, all of the posts I made during the 2.5 years of research that I did. Plus, you'll find all the social media links on that website.
Thank you so much. I Will Ruin You, Emilio Corsetti III, The Twisted Truth Behind the Kit Martin Murder Trial. Thank you very much for this interview, and good night.